wall is the improvement of investment climates by other means. Clausewitz for dummies.
The Scott Horton Show.
Taking out Saddam Hussein turned out to be a pretty good deal.
They hate our freedoms.
We're dealing with Hitler Revisited.
We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? So we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand.
No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin military action in Libya. That action has now begun.
When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
I cannot be silent in the face of the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
All right, you guys, introducing Derek Davison, writing again for Jim Loeb over at loeblog.com. Only the best stuff there. This one is called 60 Minutes Imagines a Different War in Yemen. Welcome to the show, Derek. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, good to have you back on the show. So I didn't watch it, but I saw on Twitter everybody complaining that there was no mention of America's role in the war whatsoever, so I'm glad I missed it. So go ahead and state your case. Let's hear.
Yeah, so I unfortunately didn't miss it, despite my best efforts.
Really sorry about that.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the first segment of last night's 60 Minutes was about the war in Yemen and the starvation specifically that it's caused. And... you know, they did, I don't know how long the segment was, maybe 10 minutes of, you know, discussing the humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding there and the showing these horrible images of starving Yemeni children and talking about the you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who are at acute risk of dying soon and the millions more who are suffering from malnutrition. And there was no mention at all of the fact that the United States is enabling all of this. So it just was so egregious. And, you know, this is a thing that happens over and over again when American media talks about Yemen. They either downplay or ignore the fact that this all wouldn't be able to happen. I mean, it couldn't, literally couldn't be happening without the United States going along with what the Saudis are doing. So, you know, it just hit me in the moment, and I wrote a, you know, a little rant, I guess, about it.
Yeah, good times. Oh, thank goodness you did, too. So, listen, I just saw Marcy Wheeler. It's apparently from yesterday or something, but a good tweet where, I mean, she was getting some response saying, how come we're calling this a famine instead of a genocide? When, you know, a genocide is when it's a deliberate famine being inflicted on somebody by somebody else. In this case,
right,
us, on them. And, of course, that's the reason, that's the answer to the question. Because America, the world empire, and Saudi Arabia, our satellite, we're the bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's a political distinction, right? I mean, to call something a genocide...
well, as compared to just when it's a drought and people go hungry because they have a poor economic system and bad weather, which is...
right, but I mean...
Mother Nature can be mean, but that's not genocide, right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I mean, but, like I said, I think she's right. There's really... this is a deliberately inflicted, you know, starvation crisis that I think could easily be called a genocide, but because, as you say... you know, we're the ones doing it, or we're the ones enabling our buddies to do it.
Yeah.
You know, the political...
so let's talk about that. So there's a phrase called plausible deniability, and the easiest example that comes to mind to me, I'm sorry if this is a lazy one, but Ronald Reagan wanted to sell some missiles to the Ayatollah at the same time he was backing Saddam against him in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. And, well, I don't know if Reagan was even in on it, but his men anyway. And what they decided they would do is they would have the Israelis sell them some missiles, and then we would pay the Israelis back because then it would be plausible deniability. But in fact, most people don't even know that part of the story, one, because Israel's involved, and so don't talk about that, but mostly because it wasn't plausible. right? It was just deniability, but everybody saw right through it. It was Reagan selling missiles to Iran. And as the story goes, Reagan sold missiles to Iran. And the deniability part is just a footnote in the story, right? So in this case, everyone says, oh, the Saudi coalition. But if it can't happen without the world superpower enforcing the blockade, delivering all the weapons, providing for the carrying and feeding of the weapons, the refueling of the planes on their way to their targets, according to the LA Times, helping pick the targets, et cetera, all of this stuff. Is that plausible that this is a Saudi war at all? Or this is no different than George Bush marching the 3rd Infantry Division into Iraq in 2003?
I think the distinction I would make between the sale of missiles to Iran and this is that that was an intentional American policy that we funneled through a third country to, as you say, provide some semblance of plausible deniability. This war is very much what the Saudis want to be doing. The reason that we're enabling them is because we want to maintain good relations with the Saudis. And particularly under Trump, one of my pet peeves that didn't obviously come up in the 60 Minutes piece, but is when writers refer to this as the Trump policy in Yemen, when in fact it started under Obama. And the reason that Obama got involved was this was at the same time that he was doing his nuclear negotiations with Iran, and it was sort of a quid pro quo. That if the Saudis didn't make too much fuss about those negotiations, America would back, whatever insane policy they wanted to pursue in the region. It's certainly our involvement has escalated under Trump. I think there was a, I can't remember where it was now, but there was a report just a week or two ago that said, we've done vastly more, we've more than doubled the amount of refueling aid this year than we had done by this point last year. So our involvement has escalated under Trump, but that's, a product of his overall, pro-Saudi agenda, which is just, far beyond even the usual American president.
Let me try to split the difference then. What about the policy in Syria, where that was placating the Saudis too, going along with that policy? And yet, we all know that if Obama had said, or I presume, you can correct me if you disagree, I presume that if Obama had told the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, and the Israelis that you guys may hate Assad, but we hate Al-Qaeda more, and we're the boss, and we say, no way are you backing the uprising in Syria, then that would have been the end of that. And that was plausible deniability, too. Flint Leverett, from the National Security Council and high-level CIA analyst, he was on the show in probably 2012 or 13. And I asked him, well, this is just plausible deniability, right? Oh, the Saudis are doing it. But who's zooming who here, right? And he said, that's right. It's America's policy to back these terrorists against Assad in Syria. We're the power and Saudi works for us. And so placating them that's certainly part of it, right? But is it really fair to say the policy belongs to Riyadh and not DC?
Right. I think it's in Syria, you're right. It was American policy that Bashar al-Assad was a bad dude and, he was allied with Iran and Hezbollah and they were trying to create this Shia crescent across the Middle East or whatever. That was United States policy that we wanted Assad gone. And we saw what happened in Egypt when Mubarak was ousted, who was a U.S. ally but was, a dictator along the same lines, and we saw an opportunity to get rid of an unfriendly dictator in Syria, and so we went in on the side of the opposition. I think that what happened to the Obama administration was they, jumped in with the rhetoric that Assad must go, and he's illegitimate, and he's killing protesters and all this stuff. And then came to realize after they'd done that a lot of the opposition, or at least the most active opposition, was made up of Al-Qaeda and ISIS types. And so they had to try and pull back direct American any direct American aid to the opposition, but instead, you know, use countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia to funnel aid to them.
Sorry, hang on for just one second. Hey guys, here's how to support the show. First of all, sign up for the podcast feeds at iTunes, Stitcher, and all of that. It's all at scotthorton.org. And also stop by scotthorton.org/donate. Anybody who donates $20 now, you're first on the list to get the audiobook of Fool's Errand in audiobook when it comes out in just a couple of weeks here. Anybody who donates $50 or more to the show, you get a signed copy of the book Fool's Errand in the mail there. And anybody who donates $200 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate, you get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks, and yes, including mine, again, when it comes out in a couple of weeks here. And then, everybody, you can also sign up, as many of you do, and I really appreciate it. And you all appreciate it, too, because it keeps the show going, these weekly and especially these monthly subscription donations at paypal.com. Just go to paypal.me/ScottHortonShow. Or again, scotthorton.org/donate. Shop amazon.com by way of the link on the front page of my site. And hey, leave me a good review on iTunes, on Stitcher, and on amazon.com if you read the book and liked it. And now, I mean, I guess I see what you're saying, that it was, and you know, Patrick Coburn wrote at the time too, that a huge part of this was just internal politics inside Saudi Arabia. MBS, the new, or the now crown prince, making his reach for the crown at this point, at that time was the brand new deputy crown prince and defense minister, and he launched this
to
solidify his
right.
His political position inside the kingdom. There was a big part of it, and that was the New York Times story, and I try to repeat this all the time because I think it's so relevant and important and correct. I think it's true. It's in one paragraph they have my two favorite quotes about it. They say, on one hand, they knew the war would be long, bloody, and indeterminate. And then, but anyway, they decided to go ahead and do it anyway because they had to, quote, placate the Saudis because of the Iran deal, as you said. But that was the quote, to placate them by starting a war they knew they couldn't win. They knew they couldn't finish. And oh, well, like George Bush, oh, well, that'll be up to some other president to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's
Hillary will take care of it. Don't worry.
There's certainly a failure of strategic thinking involved in this, particularly because they've sort of gotten rolled back now in the last few months. But for a while, the only party in Yemen that had benefited from the war was Al-Qaeda. So, you know, we were directly sort of working against our own interests by aiding the Saudis and destroying Yemen and leaving this vacuum for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to fill. I mean, it was just, I think it was no more than, you know, a very short-term, you know, notion that we need to do something to keep the Saudis happy, and so we'll support them in this.
Yeah. Well, see, but this is the thing, though, right, is, and I'm sorry to keep harping on this, and I know it's just a metaphysical construct. It's not even really a thing, responsibility. You know, it's a noun, but it doesn't have mass. But the deal is, though, that we have all the power and they don't. And if we weren't selling them more and more bombs all the time, which is, you know, the U.S. government has to license all of that. Of course, it's part of the foreign policy to do that. And if our mercenaries weren't taking care of all the maintenance for their airplanes, and if our Air Force wasn't refueling them, and if our Navy wasn't backing them up in the blockade on the sea, none of this would be happening at all.
Right.
So that's, really, that's isn't it really true. Our war? You know what I mean?
Like, I mean, it is. I think it's, you know, it's not intentionally our war. It's sort of, you know, our war, it's become our fault because we lashed ourselves to the Saudis and have refused to reconsider that decision. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I definitely would agree that it's our fault. The responsibility here, I mean, certainly the Saudis are to blame as well, but America is right there with them.
Yeah. And now, so tell me this. It seems like, and 60 Minutes is going to be a poor example of this, okay, but I guess it's about half of one. It seems like this story is finally catching on here a little bit. It started out, it was just, you know, Rand Paul and a couple of others. I don't know all their names, but there are a few heroic congressmen on this issue and senators over the past couple of years, but very few. But it seems like this is starting to catch on. And part of it is that people are sick and tired of the Saudis at this point after 16 years of terror war and seeing how counterproductive our alliance is with them for those reasons. You know, even in the New York Times when they run a front page story about, oh, look, the Saudis have been bankrolling the Taliban all this time. We've been fighting them and you know, all of this stuff. People are sick and tired of them, right? And so maybe, is it possible you think that there could be, I don't want to say a sea change, but some kind of real, you know, stepping up of understanding in D.C. that, hey, look, we have to stop that. We can't wage a war of starvation against these people like this. This has to stop, like, you know, before Christmas, like right now.
I mean, I think D.C. is always the last place for things like that to catch on. But I do think that there's an increased public awareness that's had to do with a lot of different things. I mean, as the Yemen, you know, as Yemen gets more coverage, the release of the 28 pages from the 9/11 report that dealt with Saudi Arabia. There's a number of things that have happened in, you know, the last year or two that have, I think, caused the public to rethink America's relationship with Saudi Arabia. And that's starting to kind of take a little hold in D.C., but, you know, it's always going to be, you know, that's the last place for a major rethink of American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. But there was the resolution that Ro Khanna, the congressman from California, mm-hmm. Just got passed. It was a toothless, you know, sort of declaration of Congress's opposition to the war, but
they had a
passed.
Good one. They had a good one. H.
Oh, they did.
Res 81,
yeah, they had
they
to.
Killed.
I mean, they wouldn't have even gotten it to the floor. They had one that called for, you know, the immediate end of American involvement in the conflict, which would have been great. But the House leadership, you know, wouldn't let it come to the floor like that. So they had to take it down to this, you know, statement of displeasure, basically. But that's a sign, I think, that there's, you know, even now in D.C. and on Capitol Hill, you're seeing some recognition that this relationship is toxic and it's taking the region and the world into some bad places. Unfortunately, the very last place you're likely to see anybody reconsider this is in the White House. You know, this administration above even the Obama administration or the Bush administration, you know, I mean, God, George W. Bush was holding hands with the, you know, Saudi royalty walking through gardens. But what Trump has done, you know, exceeds even that. I mean, he's so deeply, deeply committed to doing, you know, going along with what the Saudis want that it's hard to imagine him changing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm kind of conflicted because I have this dissonance in my head about how, well, you know, don't worry, we're told all the time. Madison McMaster there, and they're brilliant geniuses. They're warriors with PhDs, and they know what to do. And then, yet at the same time, yeah, they're just kind of accidentally stumbling, sleepwalking, being sucked into this conflict by their allies that they just can't seem to corral. Where it seems like, come on, you know,
well,
again, with
yeah,
the,
I mean,
who's got all the power
come at
here?
It from the perspective of the U.S. military, which has, you know, basically is dogma at this point that Iran is the enemy, and we have to do anything we can to, or, you know, any opportunity we have to counter Iran and support the Saudis is good just, you know, for that reason, just for the regional balance of power, you know, absent any other considerations. And that's, you know, I definitely wouldn't look to those guys to be the voice of reason on something like this.
Yeah. And now, so I'm sorry, this sort of goes without saying, but geez, it shouldn't that, you know, as we're learning here, this is the worst cholera outbreak in recorded history.
Correct.
This is the worst time that ever happened to anybody. And,
right,
this is the real irony of this, too, is that, and I've learned this from talking with Claire Manera from Doctors Without Borders, who's on the ground there trying to save people's lives, that if you can just give them some fluids, they can survive. They don't even need antibiotics. They don't even need medicine. They just need enough fluids to survive 2 or 3 days to get through the worst of it, and then they're good. But otherwise, they dehydrate to death. And so here's the most treatable illness, the most treatable fatal illness you could possibly have. You
shouldn't even have to get it in the first place.
Right. Well, yeah, that too.
You know, the total breakdown in services and utilities. It's, you know, I mean, it's going to cross a million cases by the end of the year, most likely, which will be a first. It's already the biggest outbreak of cholera that's ever been recorded. And it's there's no way to even get the fluids into people because the Saudis have now instituted a total blockade on airports and seaports and even land routes into the territory that's controlled by the rebels, which is where the most acute need is. It's only going to get worse. It's only going to keep getting worse.
All right. So now, what about them snooty French and those busybody British and the pain in the neck Germans and all these people? Are they saying anything? Are the Russians or the Chinese saying anything about this on the UN Security Council at all? Is anybody pursuing real diplomacy here?
Not that I've seen. I mean, Yemen is unfortunately not at the top of anybody's strategic thinking, plans. So, you know, Britain is almost as culpable as the United States in terms of weapon sales to the Saudis. They're up to their necks in what's happening. And Russia is, busy trying to cultivate its relationship with Saudi Arabia. China has sort of a no-problem strategy in the Middle East, so they tend to try and stay out of these things. There really hasn't been any, as far as I know, there hasn't been any push at the UN for some kind of resolution.
There's been like some aborted little kind of meetings in Kuwait and whatever, but that never
went right. I mean, the UN itself is trying to move a peace process forward, but the Saudis are a huge impediment even to that. They put President Hadi, who's the nominally legitimate president of Yemen, basically under house arrest in Riyadh. They won't let him leave. And there's no sense that even if he wanted to negotiate that he would be allowed to, because the Saudis are in the driver's seat.
All right, sorry, hang on one more time here real quick. Hey, you guys, buy this book, No Dev, No Ops, No IT, by Hussein Badakhshani. It's on Amazon.com. It's in the margin at scotthorton.org. Just like The War State by my good friend Mike Swanson, A Great History of the Rise of the Military-Industrial Complex After World War II. Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. That's rrbi.co. See how easy to remember that is if you grew up playing baseball? rrbi.co. And there's no charge if you buy in Bitcoin. LibertyStickers.com for your anti-government propaganda. TheBumperSticker.com for pro your band or business propaganda. 3T Editing to make your book read good. TomWoods.com to make your brain know stuff. Darren's Coffee to get you up in the morning. Go-Kart Galaxy for parts for your mini bikes and go-karts. And if you want a brand spanking new 2018 model website, just go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. Should I ask you about the purge in Saudi and the rise of MBS here?
Sure, I wrote about that for Jacobin a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't see that, but I'd sure like to hear. So we know that, as I mentioned, he was the brand new deputy crown prince and defense minister at the launch of this war. He's the one who launched it in Saudi.
Right. I think he was just defense minister when they started the war, but he became deputy crown prince shortly after that.
Oh, during the war. So there you go then. Right, just like Palpatine.
And he's now, scratched the deputy. He's just the crown prince, and likely, before too long, is going to be king.
Mm-hmm. And now, I really have neglected this story. I've done a couple interviews about it, but I've not done nearly enough reading. But I did see a great thing at Moon of Alabama, where Bernard was writing that, basically it's the Salman, I mean, led by him, but it's the Salman family purging the Nayefs and the Abdullahs. And marginalizing their influence, and I guess those are the cousins. I'm not exactly sure how it breaks down. But the point being, I guess, that that's not how this works in Saudi, that they always have a real consensus among all the princes and princelings for the leadership, and that there hasn't been this kind of a ruthless purge and change of regime in this fashion, within recent memory anyway. I guess I don't know the ins and outs of it. But that you know, he's making some really powerful enemies, and so how this is going to shake out is far from determined, that kind of thing. What do you think?
Well, he's making powerful enemies, but he's stripping them of their power in the process. Like, he's taken the one of the things that the Saudi family has always tried to maintain is a division between the three main armed forces in the country, which are the National Guard and the Interior Ministry police and the military. And he's purged now, he purged Mohammed bin Nayef, who was crown prince and, you know, was ousted so Mohammed bin Salman could get promoted. He was also the interior minister, so he's purged him from the interior ministry. This latest purge nabbed Mutaib bin Abdullah, who was the head of the National Guard. And he's replaced these guys with people that he presumably knows are going to be loyal to him and indebted to him. So he now controls all of the kingdom's military power. There've been reports now that these princes that they've been arresting ostensibly on corruption charges are actually being shaken down for their money, basically, and they're going to have that money appropriated by the state, which obviously takes a great deal of their power away. So I think he certainly must be making enemies within the family, but the mechanisms by which those other princes could do something about it are being taken away from them. And, you know, Mohammed bin Salman, for now at least, is pretty popular with the Saudi people, or at least with young Saudis. So he's got a popular, populist base of support.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're making a big deal about what a reformer he is. He's let women drive. That's pretty progressive if you're coming from the Stone Age. I can see that. So, and now it's funny. I mean, Adam Johnson at Fair had a great piece about this sickening kind of lapdog approach that the New York Times and the Guardian specifically, he singled out, were taking to this, that, oh, what a moderate guy. Yeah, he's going to abolish Wahhabism and replace it with Sufism or some kind of thing, you know.
He talked about returning Saudi Arabia to moderate Islam, which is makes no sense whatsoever from a historical perspective. There's no moderate Islam to return it to. Saudi Arabia's always been extremist.
Well, and is that just a PR stunt to tell the Americans that, don't worry about me, you know, I'm going to bring them all into the 21st century now? And
I mean, it's a PR stunt, but it also gives him cover. The headlines, the big splashy stories here have been, you know, he's arresting billionaires and princes and all these prominent Saudis. But he's also arrested a lot of regime critics that are just, you know, writers and religious figures, preachers, and, you know, from all across the spectrum, from people who would like to abolish the monarchy and democratize Saudi Arabia to, you know, people who think that the monarchy is too liberal and corrupt. I mean, he's rounding all of those people up. And I think, you know, to talk about restoring moderate Islam, whatever that means, gives him cover to continue to do that kind of thing and, you know, justify it in the name of this supposed liberalization.
Right. Yeah, it's funny, right? They can completely, on 60 Minutes, completely omit America's role in the war, in the Saudi war there in Yemen. And then when it comes to coverage of the new would-be king, they can just omit all mention of the Yemen war at all. That somehow
right.
This is this great, yeah, he's like the Al Gore of Saudi Arabia or somewhere else supposed to
right
love
now,
him.
Yeah, because he's got all these, you know, big ticket projects like his... you know, they said they're selling part of Aramco for billions of dollars, and he wants to build a giant new mega city that's going to be, you know, the future of Saudi Arabia. I mean,
I can
just
see the similarities
with
Al Gore.
Kind of dazzling people with big stuff while he does some terrible things under the radar.
Right. Yeah. Well, and what a poor working radar it is, huh? It's a selective kind of a thing, you know?
It's very selective, yes. Yeah.
All right, listen, you do great work. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Derek.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be here.
All right, you guys. That is Derek Davison. he's got this piece over at the Loeb Log. 60 Minutes imagines a different war in Yemen. No, they just need some more aid money for select NGOs, and they're going to take good care of everything for you, okay? That's all you need to know. All right, scotthorton.org. Sign up for the RSS feed there. I got 4,500-something interviews for you in the archives there. scotthorton.org. Check out my institute, the Libertarian Institute, at libertarianinstitute.org. Buy my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. It's at foolserrand.us and on amazon.com, of course. And follow me on Twitter. Oh, wait. Read the articles I want you to read at antiwar.com and follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks.